Welcome to Machine Visions, a show about the acceleration of robotics deployed across every sector of our economy. I'm Nan Lee, Managing Director at Obvious Ventures. In this five-part series, we dive into the current breakout moment in industrial robotics, where next-gen robots are taking on new challenges and scaling rapidly in production. We'll bring you the inside story from leading voices in this industry to understand what's happening today and what's to come. To start off the series, robotics legend Rodney Brooks will be offering some perspective from his four-plus decades working in the space. Rodney is a multi-time founder of companies like iRobot and Rethink Robotics, professor emeritus at MIT, and longtime leading voice in all things robotics and AI. We'll dig into what he sees in the near future of robotics, the challenges to be solved, and the approaches we'll need to get there. Rodney, thank you for being here.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
First off, could you share a brief history of your involvement in robotics?
Yeah, I grew up in Australia where I wrote a really bad thesis on machine learning in 1977. Then I came to Stanford, did a PhD in computer vision in the robotics group there. So I've been in professional robotics groups for 44 years now. Went back and forth, postdocs at CMU, MIT, faculty at Stanford, and then faculty for a long time at MIT, where I ran the Artificial Intelligence Lab and then founded the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab. And along the way, I've done, I think it's six startups. The best known one is iRobot, which does the Roomba.
So what was the state of robotics when you first started your PhD?
I did my PhD in computer vision from 1977 to 1981 at Stanford. And in computer vision, I processed three images on a mainframe. They took a week each to process. So it's a lot different than what we have today in terms of processing power and the capability of pushing vast amounts of data through, which we just did not have at all at that time.
Mm. You mentioned founding iRobot in 1990 and helping to make robotics really a household name with the Roomba product. Can you talk a little bit about the founding of that company in terms of what got you started? What was the impetus to start a consumer electronics company in the first place? And, you know, what do you think made the Roomba such a breakout success?
Yeah, when we started iRobot, it was not a consumer company. It was a space exploration company. And we were trying to put rovers on the moon or Mars, wherever we could get them. We went through 14 failed business models until 2002. And in 2002, we had two successful business models the same year. One was military robots, which we sent to Iraq and Afghanistan to deal with roadside bombs. And the other was the Roomba. Now, we weren't the first people to make a robot vacuum cleaner. Electrolux had one out, and it sold for 2,000 euros. We didn't think that was going to get a big uptake. Mm-hmm. So we talked to people and we sort of got the idea that the amount of spending a person, a man or a woman, could do at a mall without their spouse getting too angry at them was around $200. So that was the start of the design. We had a spreadsheet with $200 in the bottom right-hand corner, backed that through profit margins, distribution, et cetera, cost of goods sold, bill of materials. And that told us exactly how much we could spend on components. And that was what drove the design. And we came out with a $200 robot vacuum cleaner. So I always say that price can be very important in inventing a new category. If it's a new category, but it's way too expensive, you just won't get the volume. You won't get many people thinking it's practical. So you have to look at price very carefully. And then you have to weep as you eliminate things you know you could put in the product, but you just can't afford to do it and hit that price point.
Right. In many senses, price is a catch-all in a way to encapsulate technological readiness. And it's interesting the sort of stark contrast that you've talked through from your Stanford days, where computational capacity was limited to mainframes and the sort of capabilities of perception and computation were so limited. And you know, fast forward to 2002 when the $200 robot was developed. You know, in terms of the tech readiness pieces that had to fall in place, Was that a factor, you know, in the years between 1990 and 2002 for the Roomba to come out? And were you waiting on certain pieces to fall in place or developing them yourself?
We didn't have a lot of computation on board. It was a very slow 8-bit processor with 512 bytes of RAM. It had a bigger ROM. So we couldn't do any vision. We had to have sensors which were essentially 1-bit sensors, proximity sensors, cliff sensors, etc. We had to think very carefully about what we were sensing because we had to have a low computational budget to hit the bomb. But back in 1990, even that we couldn't have done because microprocessors were still quite expensive, the capability that we needed. Memory was still very, very expensive in 1990. We had brought out another robotic product that we made in also manufactured in China around 1998. And there we only had 128 bytes of RAM. So by 2002, we could have half a kilobyte. That was a big deal in the sort of intelligence we could put in the system. But I must say that it was also important, really important, to get the mechanical systems right. So the Roomba never would have succeeded as a product if it had fallen downstairs and hit people. That would have been horrible outcome, and there would have been lawsuits. So we had a triply redundant system. Two of those three redundancies relied purely on mechanical aspects, not the fall downstairs. We had to invent those. And because we were trying to do a product that we could sell for $200, there couldn't be much battery capacity. So we only had 30 watts to do cleaning. And at that time, any vacuum cleaner used 300 watts. So we had to do mechanical invention of how to clean floors in a different way than a conventional vacuum cleaner. Then there was the intelligence and the AI and the other components. But academics often, you know, well, I've got this little piece of technology. It's the greatest thing in the world. But in robotics, it's only ever a small part of the big picture. And there's lots of things that have to come together.
I think that's actually a really important lesson for hardware entrepreneurs everywhere, is to hear a leading technologist and roboticist talking about things like durability, edge cases, built-in materials, and pricing. Those are not typically things that you associate with robotics, which is, you know, the public conversation is always oriented towards R&D. But to make something work in the craziness of the real world, there's so many factors to consider. And I think that's one of the most impressive things about a product like Roomba is it goes into households. These are uncontrolled environments where you have no idea the layout, the environment, the human error that's associated with operations. Thinking back to that time pre-launch, how did you prepare for that? And when did you make the call that the product was resilient enough to be released and to be ready? And what was that process like?
Yeah, well, I'll just say the other aspect of it is when you're doing a consumer product, the customers, the people that unbox the system, are not going to be robotics experts, and they're not going to want any cognitive load on them at all. It just has to work as soon as it comes out of the box. First, we built a fake apartment in our industrial space, and we had our prototype Roombas operating in that. We had outside people come in and try to switch the Roomba on and use it. And we got a few things wrong in the first case, still, even though we did that. We grossly underestimated the amount of dirt in normal houses. And where was the dirt? The dirt was all under the beds because no one ever cleaned under their beds. So when we did release it and it was out in the wild, it would go under a bed and just run around in circles because there was so much dirt there, and then the bin would be full, and then at the first version would switch itself off when the bin was full. So everybody's Roombas switched themselves off in under the beds where they couldn't be reached, full of dirt without having cleaned the rest of the house. So, right. You know, a lot of things we didn't know when we first put it out there. And that's also an important lesson. You got to put it out there with lots and lots of users to find out all this stuff that you just didn't think through, you know, in your protocols, however careful you were. And the first version is going to have lots of things wrong. And so you're going to have to be ready to come out with a second version pretty quickly.
Yeah. It seems to me that a lot of the principles of iRobot in terms of, you know, user mentality and low cognitive load, working out of the box, being resilient, a lot of those things are not just oriented towards consumer robotics. If you look at the next company that you founded, which is Rethink, going after industrial applications, those principles seem to hold true as well and still hold true today. So I'd love to hear a little bit about the founding story of Rethink and how many of those lessons from iRobot were applicable as you went into the industrial sector.
Yeah, I think many of the lessons were applicable. I didn't necessarily apply them, though, which was a problem. The first thing was that I had really decided early on that we were going to build robot arms, but not for the industrial market. So I was trying to build a low-cost robot arm, like the Roomba was a low-cost vacuum cleaner. So I took that lesson, and I targeted a low price. But then I lost control of my engineers, and that was a lesson I've learned going forward. And they ended up building a more conventional robot arm with some new capabilities, and then the price wasn't dramatically lower. And so now the only people we could compete with were people putting robot arms into factories, and so that became our market. Mm-hmm. So that was a lesson that I knew about, but I didn't enforce. What we did enforce was ease of use, and that you didn't have to know how to program, because conventional industrial robots at the time all used some sort of code, all based on some usually old computer language. Maybe it was Pascal, maybe it was BASIC even, and you had to be a programmer to control the robot. We did it where you could teach by demonstration, where you could grab the arm, show it things, have cameras recognize objects, and then the system could do a task in the factory without any programming. So code-free was something that we did bring, ease of use, graphical user interface with modern tools.
Yep. Given that you set the stage early on, I'd love to get your view on what is the identity of industrial robotics today? And I do think a lot of the principles of Rethink carry over, but how would you think about how to describe the differences of robots being developed today versus a decade or more ago?
Well, I think you're right. The barrier we did break was getting rid of cages and that robots and people could be in the same space, which does end up changing a lot of the equation of how you have to install them. Previously, industrial robots, 70% of them were in automotive, and they were in the welding shop to weld the bodies and in the paint shop. And in both those areas, there were zero people. Then in a final assembly, there were virtually no robots and all people. There was a partitioning between where people could be, where robots could be. That has changed. And today people expect robots and humans to be in close proximity and to be safe. And so that's a big change in the last 10 or 12 years. But at the same time, you know, and I have visited hundreds and hundreds of factories around the world in many, many countries, many continents. Manufacturing itself is a low margin business. That makes manufacturers very conservative on changing technology because they can't afford mistakes. They can't hide a mistake. So they want to know that it's going to work for them before they will change their process.
Right. What are the levers that drive change? What is breaking that mindset? Is it technical capability or price point?
Yeah, well, I think one of the drivers of it actually is the change to e-commerce and fulfillment centers, because fulfillment centers weren't around before. Now the labor gets centralized, and then the leaders like Amazon, Alibaba, have really used automation for parts of the fulfillment to reduce their labor count. That then ripples back to other industries. Oh, those guys are actually, you know, doing well with automation and with robots. Maybe there's something that we can do, because, you know, they can see that Amazon and Alibaba are like the big monsters with amazing market caps. And so we want to be like them. What are they doing? So I think in a strange way, fulfillment has rippled back into manufacturing.
Rodney, you've written this amazing quote in one of your blog posts from a few years ago, that in my view, having ideas is easy. Turning them into reality is hard. Turning them into deployment at scale is even harder. I love this quote because to me, it really seems to outline the crux of the problem in robotics for many, many years, and perhaps is a preview to the steps that the industry will go through in the next decade. Because some of the ideas behind this wave of modern robotics, of them being collaborative, observant to their environment, being easy to use, these have been in the conversation for a number of years. But there seems to be an inflection point happening today where some of these things are actually working and some of these systems are starting to deploy at scale. So why do you think this inflection point is happening?
Yeah, well, one of the things that is powering more deployment is deep learning. And it's not just deep learning, you know, looking at lots of images. There's been some smart things about learning to grasp objects in different orientations. We don't have anything like the dexterity of human hands. But before we had almost no dexterity at all. Now we're able to pick up crunchy objects, packages with stuff in them in various ways, pick different things out of a bin that a fulfillment worker has thrown into a bin as there have been multiple orders being put together to save the amount of motion of the human worker. So these things are starting to become plausible. And again, they use vision. And so the high-speed vision, the use of GPUs or TPUs on the processors so that you can, you know, really analyze the image and get what's in there. All these pieces have come together to make this plausible in a way that was not plausible just a few years ago. We are not at the stage of a lights-out factory or a lights-out fulfillment center where there's no people. There's still a lot of people involved in both places, but more automation is starting to be deployable.
In terms of that intentional rollout of automation based on the current capabilities of technology, what excites you most in terms of where you think robots are able to make an impact today and where you think the deployment at scale is most likely to happen sooner rather than later?
So we have consistently seen automation grow over the years, and this is for a long time in Silicon Fab. You know, we're seeing supply chain hiccups, so we're going to see a lot more fab facilities spread out over the world, and there'll be a new generation of them, and more automation will be put in there, certainly. And that's almost sort of old-fashioned automation, but that's going to continue to grow. The handling of packages and of objects in fulfillment will continue to grow. We're starting to see things in farming. Not only the conventional players like Deere and Caterpillar, who have had long investments in automation, lots of startups are starting to do things which look like they're going to make a difference. Although I got to be careful because I can't point to a big deployment yet, but it feels like out of that will come some. There'll be a lot of losers, but there'll be some winners.
I know that you've been a proponent of managing expectations and hubris in forecasting technological cycles. You've written a lot about the AI bubble, for example. You know, what's the right way for listeners to level set their expectations on robotics and the current state of the industry today?
Well, I sort of overplay a little bit, but I say unless you saw a lab demo of something 30 years ago, it's not ready for prime time now. And my prime example of that is self-driving cars. The first time I saw an automobile drive at over 55 miles an hour over 10 miles along a freeway was in 1987. So that's been around a long time and we're still not at deployment. So maybe 30 years for every technology is a bit of an overplay. But if it hasn't even been done in a lab yet, it's unlikely that you can turn it into a real product anytime soon, because that means the major problems haven't been solved. And when you want to interact with customers, you got to have the major problems already solved and then solve the minor problems around that to optimize for customers. So at the moment, most things involving robotics, there still has to be a person around, a person in the loop. We've seen, you know, some hubris over reinforcement learning for grasping. But, oh man, our hands are so amazing what they can do. And yes, there's a demo of one particular sort of grasp, but that's one of 50 or 100 things we do with our hands. So we just don't have dexterity in anything like even what a two-year-old has.
Right.
You know, two-year-olds don't have the dexterity of a four-year-old or a six-year-old or an adult. So to imagine things which require high dexterity, I think it's a pretty straight decision. Not going to happen soon. If you can reduce the problem that you're trying to solve to one particular dexterous aspect, then maybe you have a chance of training using reinforcement learning, using other forms of deep learning, then maybe you can solve it. But if it's got lots and lots of different capabilities of human hands and human thought, it is not going to come soon. So be really careful about what level of dexterity you want.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I will say that deep learning, building image sets, synthetic image sets, and getting really good at recognizing particular classes of objects is really coming along. Just in the last week, iRobot, which I'm no longer involved with, announced a new Roomba that recognizes dog poop and doesn't smear it all over the floor if there's some dog poop in the middle of your floor. And, you know, they built a training set of 100,000 images of dog poop in order to do that.
Right.
So, you know, who knew that deep learning was going to solve the dog poop problem? But there it is. But it's a very specific problem. It's not all kids' toys. It's not everything. It's a specific sort of thing. So I think we're going to see those point solutions. And if you, as an entrepreneur, can see a problem that a robot could do with only one or two things that has to be learned, has to be partitioned, then there's a chance. It's going to be a lot of work, but there's a chance. But if there's 18 of them or 25 of them, no, that's not going to come soon.
Standardization is important.
Yeah, or concentration on dog poop.
Right, right. I know that you've done a lot of advisory work with a number of Fortune 500 companies around the topic of robotics and automation. So I'm curious, you know, what is their perspective on this technology, given that it's been touted for quite a long period of time? Is there a shift in mindset recently and a shift in attitude towards adoption and automation? Are you noticing anything from the industry side in their approach to robotics?
You know, I have to say that, and I have worked with many Fortune 500 companies, but the ones I've worked with have already seen that this is necessary, and they're trying to get ahead of the curve. So I haven't seen a big change yet, but we've seen a sort of an example of this where all the car companies realized, maybe they jumped in too early, but they all realized we have to worry about driver assist and perhaps self-driving. I think there's been a remarkable adoption across car companies, low-priced cars, high-end cars, of driver assist technology. The low-cost manufacturers are only lagging behind the high-cost manufacturers in basic ideas and implementation by 2 to 3 years, which I find completely remarkable that it's happening so quickly. That's not quite the same as autonomous vehicles, although many of the companies have invested large amounts there, but certainly in driver assist, which is automation, sensing, understanding, has really taken off over the last, I would say, 5 years.
And is that something that you foresee on the industrial robotics side as well, in that once there's a proof of technology, proof of deployment from an early leader, a la the higher-end vehicle manufacturers, that creates a floodgate of activity across the industry because you can't afford to be left behind?
Yeah, I think all companies which manufacture or build machines of any sort are going to get outcompeted by the companies that put intelligence in their machines, whether that's their industrial lawn mowing or farm machinery. So I think there will be competitive pressure for everyone.
So Rodney, it's been fantastic to have you here for the discussion. Thanks again for sharing your insights with us.
Thanks so much, Nan.
That was Rodney Brooks, founder and CTO of Robust.ai and professor emeritus at MIT. Thanks for listening to episode 1 of our 5-part series on next-gen robotics. In episode 2, we speak with Samir Menon, founder and CEO of Dexterity.
Dexterity is a company that is working to make repetition optional for human civilization. I'm a firm believer that human beings tend to be in touch with their deep core humanity by doing things that are new and by doing things that allow them to express themselves.
Machine Visions is produced by Obvious Ventures, investing in purpose-driven companies reimagining trillion-dollar industries. To learn more about us and where we invest, head to obvious.com. Special thanks to our production team at Pod People, Emily Shaw and Veronica Simonetti. I'm Nan Lee. We'll see you next time.